The following program is brought to you by the shortwave radio service of broadspectrumradio.com. You can find this and other interesting program at our website or via our streaming channel on Live 365. Just search for Broad Spectrum Radio. An important disclaimer. The GI Rights radio show, podcast, and website is designed to provide general information for the public and should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The information presented here should not be construed to be formal legal advice nor the formation of an attorney-client relationship. Any reference in the GI Rights radio show, podcast, or website to results obtained in a particular matter does not infer the probability of success for any individual in a particular case, as each case stands on its own merits. Also, please note that it is illegal for me as an attorney to advise you to break the law, even if following the law might violate your conscience. Please understand that it is against the law for a member of the military to leave their unit without lawful reason, aka going AWOL or EUA. It is also against the law to refuse to obey a lawful order to deploy. In the end, you have to make up your own mind about your actions. I will not tell you what to do. Welcome to episode number one of the GI Rights radio show and podcast. This program is hosted by myself, James Branham, attorney at law. In this program, I will be sharing on the topic of GI rights, on the topic of how do U.S. service members from all military branches, how can they exercise their rights? What are their options under the law? It's going to be, I think it would be an interesting show. Over time, we may also do interviews, we may also do some other things, but most of it will be me sharing from my experiences as a practicing civilian attorney, one who has worked in the military system. A lot of people don't understand this, but a military service member has the right to be represented by counsel when facing a court-martial or other administrative proceeding, and they have the right to use not only their appointed military counsel, their JAG counsel, but they also have the right to be represented by a civilian lawyer at their own expense. And so myself and a few other attorneys around the country do represent military service members in the system. And so I've been working in this area off and on for about 9 years, mostly in the context of the U.S. Army, but I've also worked with members of pretty much every other service branch. Significant number of Navy and Marine cases, just a few Air Force cases. I think I've only had one person I've worked with in the Coast Guard. Most of my experience has been a little bit unique in that I focused primarily on the cases of conscientious objectors, war resistors, and service members who have gone AWOL, absent without leave, sometimes for reasons of conscience, often for issues of mental health, physical health issues that were untreated, many victims of sexual assault, sexual harassment, as well as a lot of folks who are just unhappy, who did not want to be in the military, who want the right to quit their job when they want to quit their job, a right that is not recognized under the law currently. And so I've seen a lot of things. I've been at court, participating in courts martial across the country, as far away as Alaska, South Carolina, Georgia, New York State, Texas, Kansas, Colorado, Washington State, but I've also worked with service members in administrative hearings at the with the U.S. Army, some of the administrative boards in the Army and in the Air Force in particular. I've also worked with service members in CO hearings, as we'll talk about in a little bit. And I think almost every branch except the Coast Guard, I believe. And I don't think I've had an Air Force case. So anyway, I have a kind of broad experience. These days, though, I don't take on that many cases. Most of my work today is more in the education and writing end of things, of training other practitioners on how to do these cases, since there are very few civilian lawyers that do this work. So anyway, that's kind of what you can be expecting. This program will be airing on a monthly basis on Broad Spectrum Radio, which is a program that's broadcast on shortwave radio station WBCQ, broadcast throughout the United States, into Canada, into Mexico, and the Caribbean. We also will be available on the live streaming channel of Broad Spectrum Radio. You can go to Live 365 and then just search for Broad Spectrum Radio. You can either do that on your computer or do that with your cell phone app, for the Live 365 app. Search for Broad Spectrum Radio. This program, GI Rights radio show will be in the mix in there, so you'll be hearing the episodes occasionally there. Along with that, though, they are also available as downloadable podcasts, meaning that you can download these files, listen to them at your leisure. So you'll find links to that on the show notes and everything at the website broadspectrumradio.com. Lastly, if you have any comments, questions, thoughts for me, I would love to hear from you. You can send me email. Probably the best email these are more general inquiry emails. If you have topics you want to hear, that's the kind of emails I'm looking for. If you're seeking legal advice, you need to contact someone else. I'm not taking new cases right now, so don't contact me with that. You can. I can help you maybe find another attorney, but I'm not taking new cases at this time. But if you want to contact me with questions for maybe something to show up in the show in the future, then send me an email. Email for the radio show is jmb@jmb.bike. So anyway, that introduction out of the way, let's get started with today's program. For today's program, I'd like to give a short introduction to the concept of conscientious objection in the present-day military context. In this program, I'll spend some time deflating some harmful myths that I think do not help anybody. Secondly, I'll discuss the legal definition of a conscientious objector in the current context. And finally, I will give a quick summary of the process of being recognized as a CO, as well as some pointers to those listening who are considering this of organizations that can help them with the process. So, let's get started. So, harmful myth number one. This myth I've heard from quite a few people, and that is that conscientious objection, or CO, is only relevant in the context of a draft. Therefore, it's not really something that's important today. Part of the reason for this myth is that conscientious objection as a concept is best known in our nation's cultural imagination by way of stories about the draft during World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. Many people are familiar with the concept of CO in those contexts, but don't understand that the concept has existed both before and after that in American history. Furthermore, many people assume that the issue of conscientious objection only applies when there is a draft in place and not in other contexts. Well, two problems. Or two corrections to this myth. First of all, of course, the draft can always come back. Well, now, at the current moment, we realize that in the U.S., people are not being drafted. We still do maintain a selective service registration for young men. The odds are, within the next few years, the U.S. Supreme Court will rule that women will be subject to the draft as well, or no one is. There's really no basis now that you can argue that women can't be drafted, since women are serving in pretty much every possible combat-related role in the military. There's very few left that are restricted only to men. And so, based upon those grounds, it'll be very difficult to argue that a draft cannot apply to women as well. So, of course, the draft could always come back. And those of you listening who are of draftable age, male or female, I would encourage you to give thought to the questions we'll be discussing later, because it is always possible it could come back. Secondly, though, and where most of the show today will be focusing on, is that the U.S. law recognizes the concept of CO not only in the context of a draft, but also in the context of an active duty or reserve service member who has had a change of heart after enlistment. In other words, someone in our supposed all-volunteer army of today can change their mind, and by going through a process, they can be discharged. U.S. law recognizes this. This is part of our military regulatory system. It's there. Okay, so that myth is deflated. CO is a relevant context in the military today. It's not only something back in the Vietnam era, but it is important today. Okay, let's discuss myth number two. Myth number two is that it's fundamentally unfair. The way I usually hear this myth framed by people is that it's not fair that other soldiers have to fulfill their contracts, while some people, by claiming to be a CO, can evade their obligations, and that it's fundamentally wrong to leave the military. Well, my response to that is I, of course, do not believe it is fundamentally unfair. Rather, I believe that every person has the right to quit their job within reason. In any other civilian, in any civilian profession, I should say, you can quit your job. Now, certainly there are civil penalties sometimes for quitting your job. If you have an employment contract as a teacher, for instance, you may be penalized financially. You might lose your teaching license for a year, but you don't go to jail. If you quit your job in working at McDonald's, they might give you bad reference, but you're not going to jail. In other words, in any other field, generally, you're not going to jail for quitting your job. This is different. In the military context, quitting a job without permission, you can go to jail. Furthermore, though, there's the issue of the unfairness of the military enlistment agreement. Because the military is largely not held to this standard of keeping their end of the deal. While a service member, if they break their end of the agreement, they will get nailed. Thirdly, though, is that the question is it fair for those who are going to stay in the military to have to serve next to someone who can't pull their weight? CO, the process here, serves as a safety guard, as a safety valve for the military to allow that there are service members who are not going to cut it, who simply for reasons of conscience cannot stay there. Do you want to force that person at gunpoint to stay on the front line knowing that they can't pull the trigger? That would be a mistake. So, myth number three. This myth is that it's fairly easy to become a conscious objector, and that is an easy out. And that fundamentally, of course, the implication here is that only lazy deadbeats go AWOL. Actually, the military, they use much more colorful expressions, usually referring to bags of excrement to refer to such people. Well, I would have to say this myth is also not true. The process of being granted CO status is very difficult. We'll be talking about that in a moment. And it's designed to weed out those people who really are not COs. The system is designed to make sure that people who are seeking this status really are what they say they are. Okay, with those myths out of the way, I'd like to now move into discussing the legal requirements. What must a service member prove to be granted CO status? It's important to remember that the burden of proof is on the applicant, the person applying for CO status. They have to prove it. The military doesn't have to disprove the CO claim to keep the person in. Rather, the applicant must prove their claim and be able to rebut, of course, counter-allegations. So, there are four basic requirements. And bear in mind, this is a quick and dirty 20,000 feet up version of all of this. There's a lot of more detail and nuance on these issues. I'm giving you the very quick version. So, requirement number one, the applicant must be opposed to all wars. In other words, selective conscientious objection, saying, I would be willing to fight an unjust war like World War II, but not an unjust war like the invasion of Iraq is unacceptable. Under U.S. law, the requirement is that one must be opposed to all wars. You can't pick and choose your wars. Now, bear in mind, notice I was very precise here. I said opposed to all wars. I did not say opposed to all violence in all forms. It is possible, difficult, but possible, for a person to be able to make an argument that they might support the idea of, say, police being involved in society, who carry guns, who use force to protect people. Applicants have made the argument that they would use force for self-defense or defense of family, but not for war. The key thing here is it has to be a clear differentiation. It has to be made very clear that war is something different, and any time war is involved, the applicant is 100% opposed. Again, lots more nuance here in the practice, but this is the basic issue is one must be opposed to all wars. Requirement number two, the applicant's beliefs against war must be based on religion or have a grounding in conscience of a non-religious nature, but one that functions in the life of the applicant in a way similar to a religious person's beliefs. Some examples of this are of how this kind of plays out. Now, the religious beliefs is easy to spot. We think, okay, this is what religion is. Where the key here is that it's the religious belief of the applicant, not of the organization they'd be part of. In other words, an applicant could say, I believe X, Y, and Z, and I believe the teachings taught by this particular church, but I don't go there anymore because of some other reason. That wouldn't immediately disqualify you because it's the belief of the applicant. What if someone, if an applicant, believes one way, but their church believes something different? Again, that may raise questions, but it is not a problem in the theoretical. Now, as far as a non-religious person, many atheists, agnostics, free thinkers of all kinds have applied for CO status and have been granted CO status. The key here is that they must show that their beliefs come from a deep place, a place of conscience that's personal to them, that is real to them. As a general rule, and this is, I'm oversimplifying things a bit, but it can't just be about a logical XYZ thing. It has to be something deeper into the emotional realm, something core to the person's identity is how generally this has to be seen. Also, it's important to note that the beliefs can't be solely based upon politics, upon pragmatism. In other words, if someone would say, well, I don't think war is a good idea because there's better ways, but you still don't fundamentally believe war is wrong, that would be a problem. So, requirement number two, the beliefs come from either a place of religion or a place of deep conscience. Number three, the applicant must be sincere. The idea here is that their primary motivation for seeking CO status is conscience. Certainly, applicants are allowed to have political beliefs, are allowed to have pragmatic views of the world, but the issue of conscience must be their primary motivating factor. Lastly, requirement number four is the issue of crystallization of belief. Now, this is probably the trickiest, in many ways, of the issues. The reason is this. If someone joins the military and did not believe serving in war was right, but they joined anyway, hoping they would skate through, they'd never be called to actually serve, and then they get called to serve, they can't then say, oh, I'm a CO. The issue there is that that would be a fraudulent enlistment, because during the enlistment process, you were asked, are you a conscientious objector? Now, often that's buried in legalese, it's not made a very out-in-front kind of issue, but at least it's there theoretically. So if a service member had serious reservations, was opposed to war before enlistment, that would be a problem. Now, the challenge, now that said, if a person changes after they enlist, that's great. Often that comes by way of a religious conversion. It might be a battlefield experience. It might be an experience in training. It might be any number of things. I've heard of people, of service members having a change in their perspective once they had a child. A lot of things can trigger a change in conscience. The key is that you need to show that there was a point in time after enlistment where one's views changed and they became something else fixed in form that was stable. It's not to say that one can't continue to change after this point of time, but there needs to at least be a sense that someone has worked through these issues and has reached a point of stability. Another related issue is that certainly someone, an applicant, could have experiences from earlier in life, pre-enlistment, that may have pointed them towards CO. But the applicant needs to show that at the time they enlisted in good faith. That they, at that time, may have had these issues that were out there, strings to be tied up, but they weren't there yet. They at that point believed they could serve in good faith. And some point after the point of enlistment, things got tied up, their views crystallized. Okay, with those legal requirements in mind, for the four legal requirements must be proven, now it's important to consider the issue of the process. In other words, how does an applicant apply? How do they begin the process of seeking CO status? I'm going to give a really fast version of this. There's a lot of detail, lots of nuance here that I will not be exploring, but I'm giving the big picture view of what's involved. First of all, of course, the process begins with soul searching, with the applicant deciding, do they want to be a CO? And if so, do they want to be discharged, which is called 1A status, or do they want to be given non-combatant duties, 1AO status? An important decision that often takes many service members a significant amount of time, a lot of conversation with trusted family and friends, It's a really challenging time. Once an applicant comes through that process and decides, yes, I want to be either discharged or get the non-combatant duties, they begin the process of preparing their packet and their application. That can be done as quickly as a few days in emergencies, but more often takes weeks or months. Working with different organizations such as the Center for Conscience and War, the GI Rights Hotline, or Courage to Resist. But these are groups that can help applicants through this process. And there's others, well, Catholic Peace Fellowship is one big one I should mention, that works with religious COs. The process of preparation also involves a lot of coaching, a lot of working with the applicant to help them to write effectively, to tell their story in the form of a series of essay questions, which are tricky and convoluted, not easy to answer, but doing that in written form, but also preparing them for the interviews to come. So, once the packet is prepared, the application is done. Often, I should add, this is a 20-page document or more, along with supporting letters from family and friends, religious leaders, other people. This packet then is submitted to the command. For an enlisted soldier, that's usually at the company level to their company commander. Once that happens, often the command will balk. They will try to come up with ways to try to discourage the applicant from proceeding. But if the applicant stays strong, then what will happen next is the command chain will then set up the next levels of the process. An interview with a military psychiatrist or mental health care worker and a chaplain, both of whom who write written reports based upon those interviews. Should add, even atheists have to talk to the chaplain. Strange, but there's an interview by a psychiatrist and a chaplain. Then there's a hearing before an independent investigating officer. This is normally, for enlisted personnel, this will be at the company level, but someone from a different chain of command. So it'll be another captain, likely, but it will not be their captain, their company commander, but someone from a different chain of command who will do this hearing. The independent investigating officer will read the reports from the psychiatrist and chaplain. They will read the applicant's rebuttals, if they have them, of the reports from the psychiatrist and chaplain. They'll read all the supporting documents, the application. Then they will have a hearing where the investigating officer, will interview the applicant, will interview witnesses. The IO also can do his or her own investigation as well. They can go look for other people to interview. They may not even be called as witnesses at the hearing. After that, the IO writes a report, a recommendation, recommending either approval or disapproval of the claim. At that point, then, the applicant has the right to write a rebuttal, giving either agreeing or disagreeing with the IO and explaining why. At that point, this whole packet now, this long paper trail, gets sent up the chain of command. In each level of the chain of command going up from the company level, each of those commanders will write a recommendation, yay or nay. And each time that happens, the applicant has the right to write a rebuttal. Each time, going on up, there'll be a rebuttal. One thing I'll mention here, especially this rebuttal level, this is where it's critical to get outside help, to either work with a qualified GI Rights counselor or an attorney to help with those rebuttals, because these are really, really critical. And finally, after it goes all the way to the chain of command, it will go to at the branch level. So for the Army, it is DA Corps, Department of the Army CO Review Board, for consideration. That board will review the paper trail, and that's why these rebuttals are so important, because they're looking at the paper trail. They're not listening to witnesses. They're instead reading documents, and they'll make their decision based upon that. And then from there, for the Army, there's a final review that happens by, I believe right now it's an undersecretary, but it's a designee of the Secretary of the Army. So the branch level, the top person, they designate someone who make decisions on these, who will give a final approval. There's been some disagreement right now. For the military right now, at least the Army side, they're arguing that this designee of the Secretary of the Army has the right to overrule a positive determination from DA Corps. I would argue, and I think it'll later be litigated, that is not the case. Nonetheless, at this moment, that seems to be the line the government's taking. So the undersecretary has the power to grant or disapprove the application based upon this paper trail up to this point. From there, the applicant the issue then is, will they get approved or not? And the wait can be pretty lengthy. It can take months sometimes for word to come down, and this is a very trying time for the service member. But if they are approved at that point, within a few weeks, they will, depending on what status they ask for, either be discharged from the military or given non-combatant duties but remain in the military. Should add, if they are discharged, they're normally going to get an honorable or general discharge. They may have to repay bonuses or educational funding they may receive. That's called recoupment. So that's possible, but otherwise, they're not going to jail. There's no other penalties for seeking this status. And most often, they get an honorable discharge, quite frankly. Rare cases, they may get a general discharge based upon the totality of service, but that's pretty rare. For those who get non-combatant duties, that hardly ever happens. It's pretty rare that someone asks for non-combatant duties, but if it did, they may get reassigned to a different unit. They may end up being administratively separated before too long, but in theory, they would stay in the military, often doing a desk job or grunt work of some kind. Now, if the applicant is disapproved, the applicant has choices to make, whether to reapply, whether to appeal, whether to start refusing to obey orders, whether to give up the process. Long list of choices there. Today's program, we just don't have the time to discuss those, but we'll save that probably for the next episode, is what happens if an applicant is disapproved. What choices do they have? So, that was a very fast version of the process. There's a lot more I want to talk about. We'll save that for episode number 2. I do want to close, though, by giving some information on resources. If you or someone you know is considering applying for CO status, I would encourage you to reach out early to one of these groups who can help. The number one group I'd recommend is the Center for Conscience and War. Their website, Center on Conscience and War. Their website is centeronconscience.org. That is centeronconscience.org. One little bit of confusion, one of the sponsors of this program is Center for Conscience and Action, a slightly different website, but just look for centeronconscience.org to find CCW, the group that does counseling for conscience objectors. The other group I want to recommend is the GI Rights Hotline. They have a toll-free number you can call. They also have a website. Their website is girights.org, and their phone number, this is toll-free in the U.S., it is 1-877-447-4487. And if you're outside the United States, let me get that number for you. For outside the United States, probably the best number to call would be area code 415-360-5263. Also, I guess I should mention previously, the Center on Conscience and War, their phone number is 202-483-2220. If you call them, ask for Bill or Maria. There's other groups out there that can help as well on various things, particularly if one needs to hire an attorney. I'd contact Courage to Resist, their website, couragetoresist.org. They can help with finding funding for those who are needing help with if they need an attorney. So anyway, that'll be the program for today. We appreciate you listening. And again, you can find out more about our program at broadspectrumradio.com. Also, I want to give a moment to thank our sponsor, sponsors Joy Mennonite Church of Oklahoma City and the Center for Conscience and Action, also of Oklahoma City. We appreciate your support.
I'll dedicate it to all the nice folks in NATO. Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more die, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land.
Broadspectrumradio.com.